I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events, major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories, the unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Beautiful, beautiful day outside. I hope you're enjoying it. Maybe you got the windows rolled down, letting the wind blow through your hair. That's what I was doing earlier coming in. Highs today only approaching 70 degrees, and that's going to be the same way for tomorrow. Chilly start, too, with lows in the 50s. Highs on Friday, 73, nothing but sunshine. Another start in the 50s. Likewise for Saturday, a little bit warmer through the weekend, 75 and 77 for Saturday and Sunday. But, man, finally, first stretch of autumn weather. And you got to get out and enjoy that. Ronald Serpas joins us now, director of, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, former head of the Washington State Police, Nashville City Police, consultant to numerous departments, and an all-around nice guy. How you doing, Chief?
I'm pretty good, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Let's talk about, before we get to crime in the city, I want to ask you this about the story I saw from Missy Wilkinson back in October 6th from NOLA.com. About the graduation rate of the police academy, class 201, 7 officers out of 25, class 200, 10 out of 23, class 199, started with 33, ended with 19. How does that fit in with the national statistics or when you were superintendent at different departments? Is that normal for people to drop out the academy at that rate?
Well, it's not particularly normal over history. We used to suffer around a 5% dropout after accepted to the academy. Mm-hmm. But there are things that are changing. A lot of people are being pressured to consider policing that might not have thought about it long enough. And then once they got in the academy, maybe realized that's not what they wanted. The Police Chiefs Association, which you know I'm a member, we're going to be there all next week working. We just did a survey of our membership answered by 1,200 departments in the country. And we're finding it's very common that officers leave within the first 3 years of hire, which is a difference. So that might have some impact on officers that are coming into academies and maybe realizing that's not what they wanted. The worst view would be is they're hiring anybody who shows up, which I really hope and don't believe that's the case. But we do come to believe after all this research we've done with our departments in the country, 18,000 that we represent, smarter recruiting leads to better retention. So we need to be very clear in the recruitment practices now. Having been a former SWAT commander, having been a former mounted officer, a former motorcycle officer, we need to show less of that and show more of changing people's tires, comforting a child at a scene, helping someone find their way who's hurt, damaged, or hurt or lost or injured. Because policing is not what we see on television every day with this climbing through windows and crashing through doors. It's much more about guardianship and helping, and that's one of the things we're going to be pushing in the next year, producing a video for police departments around the country that we think has been well-researched by a lot of people to say, let's really show people what policing is more coherently. And then when they make their choice, maybe it's closer to what their expectations will be.
You know, I asked Newell about this, and he talked about when he was sheriff, the structuring of the academy, and they did some exit surveys and found that sometimes people didn't like firing a gun or when they got to the range. That was one of the things that led them to drop out. So they kind of changed it around and reshuffled it, and I believe I'm quoting him properly here, and put it kind of like toward the beginning of the training where, well, if you don't really like this, then maybe this is not for you. Does the progression of the training have anything to do with this?
Yeah, a lot of us did the same things. It used to be the case that we would lose a lot of candidates when they would take their final law exams, meaning not lawyer, but their final law exams. We'd lose a lot of people. And we'd lose a lot of people at the firearm range. And then we hired some former, believe it or not, we hired some former Marine Corps drill instructors who were firearm specialists. And they said to us, if you're losing people at the firearms range, it's likely that you're not training them well, because look how many millions of people we bring into the Marine Corps over the last generations. We taught them all how to shoot. So, yes, you have to think aggressively about the timing of some of these issues, the pressures that are built in by it, a one or done, right? You go through a 26-week academy. They save the firearms training until the 20th week. There's a tremendous amount of pressure on people that have never shot a gun before. Mm-hmm. I agree with Newell. We used to do it, too. Get all those things done up front to make sure that it is consistent with what people's expectations are. Use professional trainers. Don't assume that anybody can just pick up a 9mm or a .40 caliber and be efficient. And then particularly the harder classes, the law classes, the investigation classes, I agree. You put those a little closer to the front. And then here's the other problem, Tommy, and this is one I take most seriously as a GED graduate myself. Mm-hmm. We spend a lot of time teaching people fundamental writing skills because of the failure of many of the high schools in the country, particularly public schools. So you got to imagine that, Tommy. You bring in 20 recruits, and if many of them are struggling with basic English structure of sentencing, it's really a lot of work to bring them up to speed, because a police officer's work is driven mostly by how they write and what they write.
You know, you talked about, well, first of all, the Marines, as I understand it, I don't care if you're, as I understand it, if you, whether you're a cook or a stenographer or whatever, you're a rifle person, a rifleman when you leave the Marines, right? One way or the other, you got to be a, you got to learn how to use a rifle.
That's exactly right. I spoke with Colonel Terry Ebert about that just a few weeks ago, because someone was saying that someone who'd been in the Marine wasn't a soldier. And I said, Terry, please remind me, every Marine is a soldier first. He said, absolutely. Whether you're the commandant or a cook, you're a soldier first. You know how to use a weapon, and you can be expected to be in war at any moment. So, yes, that's exactly right.
So, secondly, when it comes to recruiting, and I know that there's some very active, you know, efforts to recruit police officers. Does that go to whether it's a job or a calling?
I think you bring up a good point. I hope that people see policing as a calling. I think it's a noble profession. But here's the issue, Tommy. I've been, myself and many others have been advocating, look, we appreciate, everyone appreciates when cities come together with funding to give recruitment bonuses. The real issue is retention. Tommy, if I recruit you as a police officer and give you $10,000 bonus, that's a good thing. But, you know, you don't become a real member of the service in full capacity till you're 3, 4, 5 years into the work. Mm-hmm. Well, that's when we're losing most of the people, when they're 3, 4, 5 years into the work. And when you lose all them by not recruiting smartly, you end up having a double hole. You're bringing in people who are not making it through the academy for whatever reason, because you're trying to push more numbers in. And then when you get to that 3 to 5 year mark, our research is so crystal clear with the police chiefs across the country, is we're losing them then too. That speaks to retention. How do we retain people after we get them in?
Is that because of what they experience on the job, where they realize this is not what I thought it was going to be? Do they do exit interviews on this?
A lot of times it's going to turn out to be, I didn't really know this was the case, but this is a funny story, and it's a true story. One of our district commanders got some new recruits when I was chief, and said to me, I can't believe Mardi Gras came and they quit. And I asked them, and they said, why'd y'all quit? And they said, well, we didn't know we had to work during Mardi Gras. I thought we could be off and enjoy the parades. Mm. So sometimes that's a little bit of a parody. But what you have is that people don't really expect until you actually do the work. And we're going to lose some by not recruiting smartly. Showing the real truth was what we hope to do. And then find a way to retain. You know, there's a huge bill in front of the Congress to it's a very complex process, but essentially police officers' widows lose substantial, if not all, of the Social Security benefit from their husbands. If you're from one of the seven states like Louisiana, where that's not counted as your contribution to Medicare, even though you paid, Medicaid, Social Security, even though you paid. Mm-hmm. So there's a retention piece, Tommy. We've got to focus a lot on retention.
You know, we go through it a little bit here in a much lesser degree, but it's, what do you mean I can't take vacation? Well, there's a hurricane in the Gulf.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, well, I want to evacuate. Well, no, that's why you have the job. That's what we do here. You understand? 8:22, we'll take a break. Pick it up. We come back. Ronald Surpass, our guest. I'm Tommy Tucker. A look at traffic now on WWL.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events, major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories, the unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
8:27, Tommy Tucker, WWL, having our weekly conversation with our friend Ronald Surpass, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, head of the Nashville City Police, Washington State Police Chief. Are you going to a Taylor Swift concert or not?
No. I'll be with the Police Chiefs Association for the next week, tomorrow.
Because I was going to say, if you are, you should let people know where you're sitting so they don't sit behind you, because they're not going to be able to see anything as tall as you are.
Well, I have the image of your wind blowing in the hair. Hair blowing in the wind. I'm still trying to get my head wrapped around that.
Yeah, I had the windows open. The hair just, it's kind of like something from Baywatch you would see. Let me ask you about this long term, because, you know, you can't think, like you're talking about the police chief. Is that here chief in town or not?
No, the Police Chiefs Association. We have, good Lord, we have 40,000 members. We have our annual conference this year. We'll have about 20,000 delegates. And we'll, I'm sorry. It's in Boston this year.
So
it's
been
in New Orleans before, but it's in Boston this year.
So let me ask you this. You can't think a year down the line. You can't think 5 years down the line when it comes to something like this. You got to think 10 years down the line. And I can think of nothing worse than having an officer that you train and you put 3 years into, 5 years into, just when they're about ready to really be competent on the street, then you lose them. So what does the future look like? What does it portend 3 to 5 years from now, even 10 years out?
You know, we're still trying to figure that out. We have some really super smart people at Michigan State University, Professor Jeremy Wilson. They spend all their time focusing on this. And I think when you consider retention, we have to think about it from the place that you and I are not familiar. If you go to parts of the country that have very strong collective bargaining agreements, the winning factor is you breathed one day longer than me. You get benefits I don't get because you breathe longer. That's a significant issue. Another issue is, how do we continue to keep pay increases in those mid-ranges, right? We put a lot of money at the front with recruitment bonuses, not against it. But what are we doing in the mid-ranges when we really want to continue to get these folks here? The third thing is, and it's a really difficult one, Tommy, a lot of officers are never going to get promoted to sergeant, lieutenant, or captain because it's just a smaller, it's a pyramid, right? So how do we keep having variety of officer duties in that 5-10 year period of experience that helps them explore new avenues of engagement? But if you're not recruiting, then you end up having gaps where people have to stay in patrol. And then third time, it really raises this question. In 2014, we had an external expert study our staffing. In 2012, we used the greatest computer programs off the shelf to study our staffing, and we thought we needed 1,600 people. Sometime after I left, they said they thought it was 1,200 people. Now we're living with around 900 people, and we're having some significant crime declines. Maybe the next administration will take the time to do a very workload-based authentication study of what does the police department really need to be in today's times, not what we thought in 12 and 14 or 17 or 18. What do we think in 24, 25, 26? Now, here's why I say that. What if it turns out we have these dramatic crime declines, which we were all happy about, and we did it with 900 people, but we're telling the cops every day that you should be sad because you don't have 1,200 because you should have 12. What if 1,200 is not the right number?
Mm-hmm.
What if it's a different number? And that's how you got to plan for 5 years out and et cetera, because if police department in New Orleans needs 1,200 people after an authenticating external validated study, then we shoot for it. But what if it says a different number that we don't know because we haven't thought about it in that term? That affects recruitment and retention greatly.
The other thing I wanted to talk to you about real quick, and we only have a minute left, is you talked about the difference in approaches between not riding motorcycles or horses or this or that, the other thing, but I guess comforting kids, and I don't mean to misquote you here, but talk about that real quick if you can.
Policing is a lot about just helping people when they call you. You don't get to pick what they call you for. So we respond to everything as usually the government's most visible arm, and that's where you meet people where they live. You find people who are sad because their child isn't home yet. Can you help them? You find people who are sad because they can't find their way through the city because they're lost from another town. You help them. That's really the essence of policing, is guarding and helping people.
Thank you, Chief. Appreciate your time as always. Ronald Surpass, Professor of Practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD Chief. We'll talk with Wesley Mueller when we come back about EVs and Louisiana adapting. Minute late, time for WWL First News. At 8:45, quarter till 9, beautiful morning to ride around with the windows open. And I guess if you're in an EV, I don't know if you hear anything but the wind. Wesley Mueller joins us now, staff writer at Louisiana Illuminator, talk about Louisiana lagging behind the rest of the country when it comes to adopting electric vehicles. How you doing, Wesley?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm
happy
all right.
to be here.
Thanks for taking the time with us. I want to ask the audience here, first of all, to chime in on the Oakland Heart Jeweler Talking text line at 504-260-1870. If you have an EV, do you use it for long-distance traveling, or do you have any trouble finding charging stations? I remember a long time ago, seemingly a long time ago, relatively speaking, I had a kid who lives in North Louisiana in Natchitoches, and there's an Exxon station there off of the highway leading to Manny that had a big four-post charging station. I didn't know what the hell it was at first, but then I figured it out. Tell me, before we get to charging stations and infrastructure, what is the trend with EV sales, hybrids, et cetera? How do they track these things, Wesley?
They're becoming very, very popular. They have sold, just so far this year, 730,000 electric and hybrids. And, it's on track to top over 1.5 million this year. The highest sales volume ever recorded. And currently, that's one out of every five cars in the United States is electric or hybrid now. And that, compare that to just, say, 2016, when it was 3%, that's a sevenfold increase. As the more EVs are on the road, we're seeing fewer and fewer gas and diesel vehicles. And it's mainly just because of consumer choice and the cost. The cost has come down tremendously. The technology has allowed the battery capacity to increase the range of electric vehicles to where they're now on par with gas vehicles, the amount that you can get from a full tank of gas. So, your question earlier about, can we use these things for long range travel? Mm-hmm. Yes, you can. If you purchase one of them that has that range capacity, the base models that are really cheap, you can get them for $32,000. And the federal government offers a $7,500 tax credit that's taken off the price at the dealership. Those will go about 200 miles on a single charge. So a little bit less. Those I wouldn't bank on for long-distance travel.
What did you say about one in five? What?
One out of every five cars today is electric or hybrid.
So with that being said, not one out of every, if you want to call them, recharging or refueling stations or repowering stations might be a better way to lump gasoline and electric charging. That's not the ratio for those, right?
No, definitely not. And so this is kind of part of the conversation around these is, do we have the infrastructure to support this number of electric vehicles? And it has been improving a whole lot around the country, but the facts, all the studies are showing that the owners, electric vehicle owners, are not really relying on this infrastructure because they're doing all their charging at night in their garage or at their house. They just plug in and charge it overnight. The public charging stations are really kind of a secondary, only use them if you have to.
When it comes to EVs, somebody texted in, if you have a Tesla, you're fine. Is there a big difference between Tesla or the other EVs that are out there, or fully EVs, be whatever manufacturer they are?
Well, Tesla is certainly the most popular EV currently. But the other manufacturers, GM and Ford, they are making huge gains, and they have a lot of different models now. So I would say that, they are catching up very, very quickly. But the funny thing is you can't buy a Tesla in Louisiana because we have a law that prohibits direct to consumer sales of vehicles.
You have to go through a dealership, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
You have to go through a dealership. So you cannot purchase a Tesla. You cannot purchase a Rivian.
Well, you're seeing a lot of them on the roads, and that thing I mentioned at the Exxon station on the highway to Manny, I think it's Highway 1, whatever the hell it is, I think that was a Tesla station. So when they have the Tesla charging stations, those are for Teslas only? You have some kind of code, or it only the connector only fits, or how does that work? Do you know?
No. So most of the manufacturers have followed the lead of Tesla in the plug-in receptacles. Mm-hmm. They tend to fit. They're kind of universal now. So,
but somebody's got to
charge.
Let me take a break, because somebody's got to pay for that power that you're getting from these charging stations. I guess, I don't know if there's a, you put a credit card down. I don't know how that works. We'll continue to talk about it. We come back 8:51, 9 till 9. Tommy Tucker talking to Wesley Muller, staff writer at Louisiana Illuminator. I'll also ask you on the WWL Okunart Jeweler Talk and Text Line 504-260-1870. If you have an electric vehicle, what is it that made you want to get one? Or if you would not buy one, what is it that prevents you from buying one? 852 traffic now, WWL. 857, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about EVs and the infrastructure that's available that are not in Louisiana with Wesley Muller, a staff writer at Louisiana Illuminator. I got a couple of texts here coming in, Wesley. I don't know if you can help us or not, but it says, has there been any movement by the legislature to make Teslas or vehicles directly available to the public and not having to go through a dealership?
The answer is no. In fact, the opposite has happened. Just this year, the legislature passed a law that kind of shored up the current state of the game. They passed this so-called freedom of choice for purchasing vehicles. It did not apply to the electric direct-to-consumer vehicles. So it was mainly to protect gas and diesel cars. So, you know, that's our state is lagging behind, you know, while the rest of the country, you know, is seeing one out of five cars, hybrid or electric. We are much, much lower in Louisiana, under 2%, I would say, which is puts us 49th in the country. So it's
49th in the country when it comes to sales or infrastructure?
Sales, yeah.
Okay.
Sales.
So in Louisiana proper, the concern would not be as much for charging as it would for people traveling through the state. Am I getting this right or not?
So, yeah, that's correct. We are building chargers, but they don't really need to, because we don't really have the great number of EVs that are around the country. Now, that's going to change. You know, even though we have this law that prevents direct-to-consumer sales, you know, they're not going to be able to keep it up, I don't think, because, you know, it's just going to become more and more popular to purchase these. And, you know, people are already kind of asking them to change it, you know, so we'll see.
I wonder where tourism fits in all of this. We'll have to ask Billy Nungesser that, because, you know, if you want people to drive in from the area, if EVs are becoming increasingly popular, you would think you'd have to have charging stations, right?
Yeah, you know, but, you know, as I said earlier, most people are charging at home. Mm-hmm. They're not really using the public charging station.
But if they're driving from Florida, they wouldn't be able to do that, would they? No.
Right, right. They would have to stop and charge up.
Gotcha. Thank you, Wesley. Appreciate the time. Wesley Muller, staff writer, Louisiana Illuminator. We'll talk to DA Jason Williams about ankle monitors and juvenile justice when we come back.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events, major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories, the unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.